Welcome, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic, Behind the Page. I hope you're having a fantastic week, and you're ready to take on one last glance at A Most Unusual Duke by Susanna Allen. And I'll just start right now. I'll have to say that I'm not really surprised that it made it onto the Gold Star shelf, but I will also admit to being rather biased when it came to my review. I really did have to keep telling myself, when I read the book for the first time, I'd not to automatically put it onto a pedestal even before I had finished it. Because, you know, sometimes if I love the original so much, sometimes I might put the sequel already higher up than it should go. And for the most part, while I was reading it, I thought it would rank at least 4 stars at the beginning. But when I finally got to the portions where Beatrice was speaking to her female friends about the nature of sex, that gave me the reason I needed to get it with the other Gold Star books. So, like I mentioned in the review, I don't think that I'd ever come across a scene where genuine sex education took place. Now, perhaps in a modern novel, it would feel out of place, but in the context of Regency England, it makes sense. Or, at the very least, our impression of Regency England. I kind of remember something I heard long ago. I think it's attributed a little bit more to the Victorians, that for a woman's wedding night, what she has to do is to lie back and think of England. I did a little looking into this particular saying. I think it originated like early 1900s, or it was printed at the first time then. I can't remember exactly, but it's just one of those things where you think of the people in the past as being like, you know, really strict and really cold. And I would like to hope, that the people in Regency England, that I hope that they were all having amazing, wonderful sex. It would be quite the letdown otherwise, because we've made it this far as a species. And if sex wasn't super fun, we would not have. So that's my idea. So back to my bias for a moment. Yes, I might have judged this book higher because of the supernatural aspect. I cannot deny what I like, so I won't. If I'm being honest, if I were to sit down and try to take a crack at writing a romance novel, I would probably go with a shifter slant. Probably more than just shifters, to be really honest. I mean, come on. My bread and butter back in my college writing courses were urban and high fantasy submissions, so that's what I was writing, and that's what I was interested in. I don't know if that I'm bored by reality. I was definitely the kid who preferred watching the animated shows versus the live action ones. When I was younger, that was coming more into popularity. It's like they were moving away from animated kid shows and getting into live action shows, and like I don't want to deal with the live action because you can get away with more in animation. I like pushing boundaries of what's expected. And for me, that means adding in a little bit of urban fantasy. I also know that shifters are huge in the romance novel game. And to press further on that effect, I know that the concept of the monster boyfriend is gaining more popularity by the minute. There's a reason Beauty and the Beast has survived this long. I mean, it was not a mistake that The Shape of Water got as popular as it did. It was not a mistake that a lot of people preferred the Beast not to transform. A little bit of a spoiler alert, I've talked a little bit about this series of books with the reimagined Disney stories. The Beauty and the Beast one, Tale as Old as Time, actually keeps the Beast untransformed. Rose Daughter from Robin McKinley, one of my favorite authors, again, spoiler alert, keeps the Beast untransformed. It's very, very different these days. It's like, come on, I fell in love with the pre-transformed guy. Why wouldn't I want to keep him? Come on, it's cool. But to move on, I am kind of late to the romance novel game, so that means I am late to the shifter party as well. I realize that there are rules to these types of romance novels, if not guidelines, that are usually followed to make a lot of readers happy. I mean, tropes are tropes, not because that they're not cliche. What I mean to say is tropes are tropes because people like them. That's why we keep using them. And I'm comfortable knowing none of the rules when it comes to the shifter novels. But something that has stood out to me from what little research that I've done and as far as I've gotten so far, it's that claiming bite. It happened in both A Wolf in Duke's Clothing and in A Most Unusual Duke. And if I understand it correctly, it's a staple of the shifter romance genre. They actually made a bit of a big deal about it with Arthur and Beatrice. If I gathered that information correctly, what happens with the claiming bite is that it's permanent. It doesn't heal in a way that would make it vanish. I guess a scar remains or something like that. So when we look at Beatrice's late husband, we know that he was a wolf shifter, and we also know that he was an absolute bastard. But he was very much a follower of the quote-unquote old ways. So while Arthur and Alfred had a menagerie of different types of shifters in their households, Castleton kept exclusively wolves near him and in his staff, a true pack as it were. So he still tried to keep hold to those old traditions. And it also kind of meant that Beatrice was very, very much alone. Basically, it's like, you know, the girl got into the club, basically, and they're not really thrilled about it. So when her husband died, Prince George actually ordered Beatrice's body to be inspected to be sure that Castleton had not made any claiming bites on her or any that stuck. According to her, there were a couple of attempts made at a claiming bite, but nothing kept. Otherwise, any wealth that would have been afforded to her in her widowhood would have been gone and taken straight into the royal coffers, as far as I know with shifter rules, I think. I don't fully understand why that would have been, but again, regency inheritance rules in general just kind of make my head spin anyway. So it was for all the good that Castleton's claiming bites never took on Beatrice, since these things were supposed to be permanent. And also private, that I would hope. Felicity had hers in a place that would not usually be seen, but Beatrice decided to have hers visible when Arthur administered his. Now, speaking of bites, I do admit that I probably gave this book a higher spicy rating than we might expect for this type of story. Shifters aside, this was pretty straight vanilla for the most part. So what is it that sets this apart from other straight vanilla books that we've read so far? So, for starters, hardly any of our heroines get any kind of stimulation outside of the regular vaginal penetration. It's pretty basic. They are expected to come with only that in and out, and magically, the guy can get them off every single time without any outside assistance. Sure, Jan, sure. If we remember, I've talked a couple of times about, you know, that 20% of women can only do this, but suddenly all of the heroines in our books can. For Arthur and Beatrice, however, they don't pretend that their first coupling is going to be easy. Beatrice even, you know, makes a note that's like, she expected this pain. There's a small little pinch of pain, but it's not extraneous to her. In theory, sex, even your first time, should not be super painful. So if it hurts, you should have done a lot more work. For entrance. Anyway, they still approach this, Arthur and Beatrice, they still approach it from the perspective of having children. That's it. But for every moment, Arthur is making sure that she derives as much pleasure from the experience as he does. Just because they're conducting a white marriage and having sex for procreation only doesn't mean that he doesn't want to take care of his partner. We saw that a lot with the way he interacted with Beatrice. They may have been shoved together unwillingly, but Arthur was still very protective over Beatrice. He wanted to make sure that she was okay, because she was, you know, stuck just as much as he was, but he had more power in the situation. And he also makes sure that they communicate with one another. He checks in with her before, during, and after. So what can I say? Communication is sexy. I think it's the care that Arthur takes with her that brought the spicy rating as high as it did. It also helped that Beatrice was introduced to more in-depth sex education by someone else other than the man who was trying to have sex with her. It can be rather problematic if the heroine's first experiences in good sex includes the guy trying to convince her that something he wants is totally normal and cool, babe, while he has her in this highly vulnerable position. It's those factors that matter when I consider the spicy rating. So even though it was quote-unquote vanilla, shifters aside, this got a 4 on our spicy rating. And I really hope to see that we get further into communication and more education and whatnot. We got something really spicy coming up next time. I promise. So, on a slightly different topic, something that I almost never do is check ratings of the books and reviews of the books that I'm reading. I especially don't want to check on them before I pick up the book, because I want my impression to be as uninfluenced as possible. If I get a heads up about certain plot points or themes, I'm already going to have preconceptions on what to expect. And while I might have biases of my own particular likes and wants, I'd like to avoid most biases if possible. Like I said before, I already had a high opinion of the book before I went in because I liked the predecessor so very much. So on a whim, I actually looked at some reviews for A Wolf in Duke's Clothing as I was refreshing myself to get ready for A Most Unusual Duke, and something surprised me. One aspect that I felt set A Wolf in Duke's Clothing apart from other novels was the narration. I felt it was appropriate for the Regency setting, and it more than met my expectations for what I might read in a historical novel. Apparently, this was a common complaint about the book. People said that sentences dragged on or they rambled a little bit, but I didn't feel bored. I didn't feel like I was being dragged around by a chain going, when are we going to get to the end of the sentence? I really enjoyed the narration. I really enjoyed the prose and how it was constructed. This was one of those moments where I kind of sit back and I think, is this a time, one of those times where I love something that's generally disliked, or if I dislike something that's been generally enjoyed? But my original points still stand no matter what. I believe that the author was correct with her use of narration and tone. I don't think I would have enjoyed either of these books as much, nearly as much, if I was faced with modern vernacular set in a Regency novel. Way back before we were hopelessly romantic, I read both A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, but I also read An Unexpected Earl. That was a different Regency novel. No shifters, I'm afraid. But the vernacular was very modern compared to A Wolf in Duke's Clothing, and that altered my perception. If I'm reading a Regency novel, I want to feel like I am reading in Regency England. It's just really a small reminder that you can like what you like, no matter what anyone says about it. Just because I put books on the shelf of shame doesn't mean that those books don't have their fans. Reading is a highly subjective activity. The author can write the best book that they want, but it's also up to the reader to complete the story with their own interpretations. Now, I think that's where I'm going to leave The Shifters of the Beaumond today. If the booksellers are to be believed, our third installment will arrive in August, so we will have plenty of chance to talk about it then. So for now, let's move on and talk about what I read for this week. This week, I read Black Sun by Rebecca Roanhorse. This got onto my radar while I was listening to the Spirits podcast. I highly recommend you give those guys a listen. They are wonderful. So after I heard about this book from them, I decided to take the jump and pretty much go in blind beyond what they had told me. And what I found was amazing. Black Sun is a high fantasy novel that takes inspiration from Native and Indigenous traditions and stories. It's really unique. It follows the viewpoint from 4 different narrators, and each one has their own distinct voice. I don't feel like people were blending in one another. It also helps that I was on the audiobook. Again, audiobooks are great because they had a different narrator for each character, and I think that they brought exactly what was needed for each of the characters to have their own voice shine through. To that end, I don't think that there's really a main character, but if there is one, it would probably be Serapio, a young man who is the reincarnation of the Crow God, a deity sacred, to the Crow Clan, one of the factions in the novel. The story has lots of different places, the big areas of the city of Tova, and they have 4 big clans, one of which being Carrion Crow. There's a lot of really unique aspects in Black Sun. One thing that really stood out to me was the abundance of queer characters. not just queer relationships, but also queer identities. More than one character falls within a third gender, and they use non-binary pronouns. It actually did throw me a little bit. One of the downfalls of the audiobooks is when I heard Sheer and Shay. I was like, what is this? Oh, okay, it's a pronoun. So this is why we need to have these things more often in mainstream media. That way I don't get thrown for a loop when I hear it for the first time in an audiobook. But if you're looking for an inclusive story, this would be a really good choice. It also kind of showcases that, you know, some areas are more accepting of others. There's a balance in there, but, you know, it's like, you know, people are people. The human experience is the human experience. Now, I will also say, the author has come under some criticism for her use of Native traditions and stories. I believe that I would be doing a little bit of a disservice if I didn't mention this, because it's really important to make sure we have these kinds of conversations. While Roanhorse does have Native ancestry, and she also has experience working in federal Indian law, specifically as a clerk in the Navajo Supreme Court, and later on becoming a lawyer, it's important to remember that the use of Native stories can be kind of fraught. One side of the argument states that Roanhorse simply used the stories and traditions for her own gain and kind of changed them to fit her narrative, and ultimately doing harm to the nations that the stories belong to. The other side praises her for writing a high fantasy novel that doesn't draw from a post-colonized viewpoint. I think it was Sci-Fi, the channel, one of their reviewers said that it sort of decolonizes queerness in a way. But, you know, it's fluid, it's motion, and people are going to take what they read and they're going to interpret it. Like I said before, it's really up to a personal perspective, but sometimes a personal perspective needs to be a little bit listened to when you are a highly colonized nation and somebody who's not necessarily from your area is like, hey, I'm going to write this story about this and I'm going to change a couple of things and you don't know. I'm not sure where I sit on this argument. On the one hand, I have no perception of the Native people's experience. It's not my place to say whether or not Roanhorse has crossed any lines, because I simply don't know. I don't have those cultural touchstones. I don't know what the stories are. I'm very, very unfamiliar with this kind of territory. And then I've gone and read this book that is very new to me. But on the other hand, it's also up to me to be conscious of the media that I consume and to strive to understand its potential impacts on society. So for now, I might say that given her background, there's a lot more that I didn't mention. Roanhorse didn't write Black Sun in a vacuum, and I don't think she approached it disrespectfully. I personally feel that she approached it from a place of love and understanding, but sometimes you know, road to hell is paved with good intentions, but I don't want to put that serious of a notion onto Black Sun, because I really recommend that you read Black Sun, because like I said, I'm not familiar with these kinds of things. I don't know about them, but that's because I've never heard them. If I've learned about them, I'm like, oh, this would be really interesting. I can go and learn more about it. I can learn about the nations. I can learn about their stories, and I can try to understand these different viewpoints. So I really do recommend that you give Black Sun a read, because we need more. We need more stories that don't follow that post-colonized high fantasy concept. Because frankly, I'm tired of all the Lord of the Rings dualikes. Sure, sue me, I said it. But I will say that Black Sun really started my New Year's reading list off with the right foot. And I think that's where I'm going to leave you today. I will see you next week when we read Master of the Mountain by Charisse Sinclair. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. Also, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will go a very long way to help the show, and that way I can keep bringing you lots of fun episodes. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hyun Cho. and Hopelessly Romantic is an Age with K production. And always remember that it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.